Welcome today to our interview series with outstanding professionals. I am Stephen Ibaraki, and I'm conducting an exclusive interview with Dominic Holt, co-founder and leader of Lockheed Martin Shark Tank organization. Now, Dom is a top international software engineer and innovator, a leading entrepreneur, and a member of the ACM Practitioner Board Professional Development Committee. Dom, you know, you've got this amazing background. You've had so many outstanding contributions in innovation, invention, and executive leadership. And I know that your insights are going to be really valuable for our audience. So thank you for taking your time to share all of your wisdom with our audience.
Oh, thank you, Stephen. I'm honored to have the opportunity to share some of my stories with you here today, and I really appreciate you taking the time to do it.
Now, one of the things that you are part of is the ACM Practitioner Board Professional Development Committee, and it's actually by invitation, and it's because of your, you know, tremendous background and success history that you have. Can you share some sort of value metrics, that things that you wish to accomplish as being part of this very important committee?
Yeah, absolutely, Stephen. I think I'm by far the youngest member of the board, and so it's definitely been interesting interfacing with so many accomplished and incredible people. But I think one of the reasons I was brought onto the PDC was to shake things up a bit. In every organization that I join, I tend to focus on what the issues are and visualize where I think the organization needs to go in order to be successful. In the case of ACM, I think there's been a lot of focus on academics in the past, and while ACM is a very well-respected organization in the software community, I think we could do more to get the practitioners involved with ACM. I personally want to provide to the actual folks getting up every morning and designing and writing software. Specifically, I think we should provide high-quality resources to make their jobs easier. Some of those resources might revolve around linking to existing good materials or providing tutorials. More importantly, there has never been a better time to start a software company, especially if you're a software engineer. And I'd like ACM to embrace the massive wave of growth we've seen with entrepreneurs in the software community and help them be successful in getting their companies off the ground. I'd say lastly, while ACM is the largest software engineering organization in the world, I think we do a much better job attracting and retaining a larger percentage of the software community as members. And I would like to see an ACM that's taking and acting on the input of at least, you know, 30 to 40% of the software community worldwide.
Well, you know, you bring this sort of very unique kind of perspective because of all the things that you're doing. And I know that that's going to be a great value to the ACM and to the ACM PDC. Now, what specific value does the PDC provide to computing professionals, do you feel?
That's a good question, Stephen. I think the ACM is an excellent platform to promote things that are important to us as a software community, and to make sure the software industry as a whole continues to move in a positive direction. I really enjoy listening to some of the webcasts that ACM hosts with influential people in the industry, and hearing from some of the greats like Grady Booch and Steve McConnell. Those guys are rock stars.
Now, Dom, you lead some of the top young engineers in the world with the Shark Tank, which you co-founded. And it's involved in capturing something like $2 billion in revenue and growing rapidly. It's just amazing. Now, based upon your global expertise, what are some of your top predictions in each of these areas? And I'm going to list 9 areas, and then if you can go one by one through these areas. So the first one being cybersecurity, followed by cloud computing, big data, mobility, modeling and simulation, web technologies, autonomous systems, rapid hardware design, and then some kind of blue sky out-of-the-box thinking. So those are some kind of 9 areas where I'd like to see some of your, or hear about some of your predictions. So let's now start with number one, cybersecurity.
Yeah, so what I will say, Stephen, is I'll give you some of the areas that I'm more involved with. What you have to know about Shark Tank is that there's a number of really incredible people involved, and it's not just me. It's a team show. So let me touch on some of the areas that I have more involvement with. So for cybersecurity, this is a really interesting and evolving area, especially in the consumer marketplace. I think people used to think that cybersecurity was something for governments and banks to worry about. But with the recent events, we're seeing like the NSA's PRISM program and the more recent Sony hack taking place. I think people are starting to wake up to the reality that cybersecurity is going to be something that could significantly affect their lives. And people are going to start being more careful about who they do business with, and business to consumer and business to business companies are going to invest significant amounts of money in this area going forward. So I really think in the consumer marketplace, we're going to see a large amount of growth in the cybersecurity space. I'll talk about some of the other areas. Cloud computing has just exploded over the last couple of years. Everything is hosted in new scalable environments online nowadays. It's a major shift from developing apps mostly on private networks running inside containers like Apache Tomcat, which is where I got my start in the industry. I think the top trend I've seen in this area, however, is the huge shift in the development community towards this DevOps concept of developers and operations synced together. Entire development and test environments are being automated and pushed into clusters on AWS, Google Cloud, and Microsoft Azure. In the big data space, which is a lovely buzzword, everyone has to make decisions every day, and a large amount of them, I'd wager, are made on gut or intuition. And if you have nothing else to work with, what else are you going to use other than, say, maybe your moral compass? So alternatively, I believe if you ask someone to make a decision but ask them if they wanted all the relevant contextual data associated with making that decision, they'd probably hug you. That's what data analytics are going to do for people who are making important decisions. And I see data scientists being the oracles, so to speak, of future companies where they prophesize market shifts and strategic moves for executives at massive companies. Mobility is another area that we do work in. I think we're on the cusp of a massive push into the wearable space, and I don't think this is probably much of a surprise to anyone. So far, we've seen a lot of wearables for fitness and health, and soon there will be wearables for everything you can think of, and probably even some of the things that you didn't think of. As far as mobile phones themselves, they're just going to find more ways to make your life convenient so you don't have to carry around so much stuff. I think anyway, you'll use your phone to turn your car on, to unlock your front door, to make payments with your credit card, to turn out your lights when you leave your house, or adjust the temperature in your room. I also see companies and brands taking more advantage of consumer mobile devices and see a world where apps will provide contextual data to users based on geolocation. So, as an example, maybe you're at the grocery store and you checked out, but you forgot the milk, and you're one of those people that always forget something at the grocery store. And you get home and your wife or your husband's angry at you because, you know, you didn't get the one thing you're supposed to. So you'll get a push notification telling you that before you walk out the door. So, you know, you're checking out at the grocery store and it says you forgot the milk. So you go get the milk and, everything's right with the world again. Definitely, there are some cybersecurity implementation, concerns with that, with these new solutions coming into mobility as well, right? And then lastly, the last group that I have a lot of involvement with is web technologies. And, largely due to Google, JavaScript has become the mainstream language for building web apps. And, we've seen a number of great new frameworks popping up to make JavaScript less cumbersome. Cause when I first started on JavaScript, it was literally an impossibility to test things and, other such problems with implementation without a lot of frustration. But they've done a great job, and mainly I'm talking about AngularJS, which has really run away with the show. Everyone wants to hire people that know AngularJS now, and they are building a really big community of developers. There's also a lot of other really great frameworks that have come out too, like Node.js, and Socket.io, and Ionic, among a large amount of other frameworks available.
Now, you know, you belong to a really famous company, Lockheed Martin, and again, a very famous gentleman who initiated something, Kelly Johnson. So how have you adapted Kelly Johnson's 14 principles, Kelly being as the founder of the original Skunk Works organization of Lockheed Martin? And how have the members of the original Skunk Works, how have they been sort of recognizing the really the tremendous work that you've been doing with the Shark Tank?
Yeah, so Kelly seems, I've never, you know, had the pleasure of meeting Kelly myself because he's no longer with us, but he was a very interesting guy from what I've been told. And if you've never read his biography, it's a really great read. I would break how we took his principles into three main areas. He had 14 points and we didn't use all of them for sure because not all of them applied to us. But first of all, I would say the first area is autonomy. And, Kelly had this principle that, the manager in the group had to be delegated practically complete control of, his program in all aspects. And he should report to a division president or higher. And so that's, just sort of like eliminate the middleman and make sure that you have autonomy to make your own decisions. So I think that's really important for creating a Skunk Works type group. Certainly no one could create the original Skunk Works again, but, secondly, I think one of the main areas is recruiting. I think back in Kelly's day, at least, and I'm sure there's still a lot of this going on, there was lots of people just thrown onto projects, especially when things didn't go so well, right? A common technique for fixing a problem is to throw smart people at it and hope it gets fixed. But Kelly said, you know, the number of people having any connection with a project had to be restricted in an almost vicious manner. And that he used those exact word, vicious manner, right? And he said, use a small number of good people, maybe 10% to 25% compared to the so-called, you know, normal system. So essentially find really good people and you don't need to have big, massive teams. Those good people will do the work. And I think, that's especially true in the software field, right? Because we have this concept of like 10x software engineers and there's this, you know, proven, on a variety of different levels of finding amazing software engineers that can contribute 10 times what an average software can contribute. And how sometimes like really inexperienced software engineers, they're software engineers that, for whatever reason have fell down a rabbit hole, you know, can actually detract from a project. So getting a few really good ones together can, really boost your efficiency. And lastly, one of the other co-founders is always saying that Kelly Johnson was the first, agile practitioner, even though he wasn't necessarily building software. He had a number of different principles that were associated with agile development. So one of the points talks about, there being mutual trust between in this case, the military project organization and the contractor. So the customer and, the developer and, very close cooperation on a day-to-day basis. So that there wasn't any communication problems or misunderstandings. He also talked about testing, and how, the company had to be delegated authority to test their final product. In this case, Kelly was building airplanes, so he said in flight. And also to test, each initial stage. So you're testing as you're going along. He talked about making changes often to, the design, and continuously iterating over it. And also working together directly with the customer, you know, in a close by place. So I think those really embrace agile development. as much as Kelly originally intended them for building airplanes. You mentioned working with some of the members of the original Skunk Works, and we've been truly blessed. We've had the great fortune of working with some of the folks at Skunkworks who actually worked for Kelly Johnson, some of which have acted as advisors to our group. We also got a history lesson and learned about how Kelly ran things at the Skunkworks. And it's kind of funny. The more we learned, the more we realized we were just following in his footsteps rather than coming up with original concepts. Even though we came to these thoughts on our own, he was a pretty innovative guy.
Well, I think it's great to get validation from this sort of amazing group. And I guess it also speaks to the fine work that you're doing. In fact, the word Skunkworks is sort of like a generic term in a way, in a sense now, sort of meaning that you're a really highly adaptive, innovative sort of research group within an organization that drives for implementation of really amazing things. And for your group to be recognized with a Shark Tank, I think that's quite an accomplishment. So because of that, can you describe your journey in the founding of the Shark Tank?
Sure. So let me caveat this with saying, you know, these are my own opinions and ideas, and they don't have anything to do with Lockheed's. Originally, 5 or 6 years ago, myself and a bunch of other people got together. They were brought together as part of a strategic process, business process improvement group. They had essentially combined a bunch of different areas together, as is common in the defense sector and probably other large companies. And as is such, they needed some help documenting how the different parts were going to work together now and what was going to be involved, what were some of the issues. And so that gave us like a real opportunity. It gave us a window into how the business was run at Lockheed. And, you know, as a young upstart engineer, and it really opened my eyes to how big companies work and how in particular Lockheed worked. And of course, as you would find in any big corporation, there was a number of inefficiencies we found and a number of problems. We ended up making a bunch of suggestions to the division president at the time about how maybe we could improve some of those inefficiencies. Some of them turned into really great ideas and that were implemented, and some of them kind of fell by the wayside. And so after we were finished with this effort, me and two of the other members kind of got together and said, sort of combine our thoughts and kept talking. And we started talking about how we could continue to improve inefficiencies at Lockheed and improve the business. And one of the co-founders had this, you know, was just enamored with Skunkworks and shared his wisdom about Skunkworks with us. And so we were thinking about ways we could provide all these things together for the business. And the best way we could possibly come up with after discussing it at length was creating a new brand and creating our own organization. And that's how Shark Tank was born. We sort of created something, we just crowdsourced what sort of teams we should build. We kind of saw them as like teams of, you know, amazing engineers or technologists that were sort of like small elite teams of ninjas you could tap to build innovative things or work on projects and those types of things. We started asking around vice presidents if they would give us, you know, like millions of dollars. Of course we were in for a rude awakening because you can't just, you know, I think that was probably our first foray into venture capital, so to speak. Even though it was entrepreneurship. As you might imagine, that didn't go over very well. So, we just started asking around what people thought, you know, what value we could provide. And a lot of programs and groups just started saying, hey, I noticed that you attracted some really impressive people. Like, have you ever thought about coming on my program or my project and helping fix some of the technical issues. And I, you know, we said, of course, we hadn't really thought about that, but we'd give it a shot. So that's how sort of the consulting arm of Shark Tank was born. And it grew, it typically doubled every year, up until last year. We did something like 200 different engagements, across the corporation. And then there's this other part of Shark Tank that was born. You know, we had this different culture, and culture is a really interesting, topic to talk about at different companies, and every company has a different culture, but we kind of manufactured our own culture by crowdsourcing, you know, what it meant to be a shark and part of a group that was trying to do innovative things. And we came up with a different group of core values. And we kind of went from there. So it's an interesting story.
You know, that the word Shark Tank, also, I mean, there's a TV program that's sort of... Did you get into any sort of confusion because of that?
Yeah, that's an unfortunate event that happened. I mean, it's a great TV show if you haven't watched it. We pretty much started around the same time the TV show did. So when we started, nobody had really ever heard of Shark Tank, the TV show. So it's we both actually have a registered trademark, the TV show, and Lockheed Martin, from what I understand. Because, you know, people aren't, most likely are not going to start a TV show at Lockheed Martin, especially not one called Shark Tank. So I don't think there's too much of an issue there. But definitely there are some confusion sometimes, even inside the corporation. You know, it's being such a large defense contractor, things can be a little siloed sometimes, and people hear about you that hadn't previously heard about you, and they ask you how you're related to the TV show. So certainly we have to clarify some of those things for people.
You know, you've got this sort of history now of engagements and many, many projects and delivering real value where you've been able to unlock and solve challenges and things like that. Do you find then that funding is easier now?
No. The simple answer is no. You know, it's a variety of different things. First of all, it's a tough environment economically for everybody, I think, right now. The economy, you know, you hear in the news it's bouncing back, but I personally don't see it. I continue to see things like cost-cutting measures. And that's a really hard thing for a company to wrestle with, right? When the money is flowing in, it's easy to, you know, like give out money for this and this and this project. But when the money's tight, you know, like it's really hard for a company to knuckle down and say, okay, we need to invest in our future. And, and there's this trade-off between the future and surviving right now, right? Because obviously the future is not that important if you don't make enough money to operate through next year. So we've seen a lot of that economic cultural change, you know, in the business. And it's always sort of a moving target for hitting funding. I would think at any big corporation, because, you know, the executives, they will move around a lot, and you have to convince executives, just like you might venture capitalists, that your ideas are good and that they're going to provide a massive return and all these things. So it's a very tricky thing. I think, interestingly enough, running and being a part of Shark Tank has taught me a lot about entrepreneurship. And I don't think we intended for that to be the case when we originally started it. But we've sort of moved further and further towards that direction just because it was a natural shift for us. I think that as we've gotten more acquainted with and learned more about entrepreneurship and venture capital, we've actually gotten better at pitching to executives internally at Lockheed.
You know, you've won some awards. Can you talk about that?
Let's see, which ones in particular?
Well, you've got so many, maybe your top three or four.
Well, one of the awards that I'm most proud of was actually kind of a fluke. I was working on a, I was in college and I was taking this elective course, called Foundations of 2D Graphics at RIT. And, it was basically making a 2D video game. And, a bunch of my friends were taking the class and I thought to myself, hey, it would be really cool to make a video game, right? Cause that's like the dream for every software developer, on the planet, like before they actually become a software developer. So I enrolled in this course and, a bunch of my friends were taking it. So, you know, that's always a good thing in college to have some people you can talk to in case you run into a brick wall. And, the professor, he basically said, so this is a really hard course and, you should leave now if you're weak of heart and, I'm going to grade you exactly like, you're going to be graded in the gaming industry. And if you miss your deadlines, like I'm going to cut your grade in half. And if I don't like your game, you're going to fail. and all this stuff. And so we had to develop an entire, you know, 2D video game experience in 10 weeks and deliver it and do the presentation. And it had to be fun, which is an interesting subjective, you know, measurement. So we actually, you know, accomplished that. And, after we finished, one of the members of our team said, hey, you know, I read this webcomic called Penny Arcade. They have like this massive, festival or whatnot every year for like the video game industry. It's called PAX. And, they started this competition called the PAX 10, where they're like the top 10 independently developed games of the year showcased. And I submitted our game. Of course, you know, being in college, we weren't even listening to them at the time. And we're like, yeah, whatever, you know, like our game's never going to win that. We built it in 10 weeks. and he came back, you know, like maybe a month later and he said, so we won. You need to buy plane tickets to Seattle so that we can go showcase it. And, you know, we were all just like, what are you even talking about? What do you mean we're going to Seattle? But it was a really great experience. You know, I got to meet people in the video game industry and that was interesting. And, it was incredible to be able to showcase something I had built with a team of really great guys, at such a venue. So that's one of them.
You know, it kind of reminds me, don't you have other stories like that where, let's say you're drafted onto some kind of a project, maybe in your co-op days, and there's some sort of impossible challenge, and you think, you know what, let me give it a shot? I think you have other stories like that, don't you?
Sure. You know, it's interesting. I come from a small town in Maine. Like there are like 5,000 people in this town, so everybody knows each other. And there wasn't a lot of opportunities for me growing up, like, doing coding in high school or anything like that. We didn't have anything remotely related to that, where I come from. So when I got to college, I wasn't very good at coding, and RIT is a pretty competitive school. So, most of the software engineers that were coming into the program, they had like 5, 6, 7 years of experience already coming in. And I had like, you know, zero. Like my experience was like developing websites, which is like not even close, to what the experience these guys had. So I wasn't really that great of a software engineer when I first started at RIT. And, a lot of the projects I worked on, you know, like were really serious projects, you know, like the first year in, and I was just beside myself. So, I had to actually get a lot of extra help from different mentors and those types of people that I met, who were all, you know, instrumental in, getting me up to speed and becoming a decent software engineer. And the first, co-op I got was working for, a signal processing company, which is an interesting gig. And, I was so insecure about, being, you know, good, that, one time after I'd been there for a while and I was writing code and stuff, my boss actually walked into my office, and he was actually the general manager because it was a small company. And he said, you know, I just want to say, you know, you've been doing a really good job and et cetera, et cetera. And I thought he was making it up. Like, I thought he was making fun of me because I was so insecure about writing, software. And I actually said to him, I said, I know that I'm struggling, but you don't have to make fun of me. And he laughed and he said, no, I was being serious. That was a really good experience for me. They gave me, this project to work on, which was, you know, probably by one of the worst pieces of software I've ever seen in my entire life. And it wasn't because it wasn't written by smart people. It was just, it was started in like 1970. And it was like, slung together with Corba with different parts in C and C++ and Java and all this stuff. And I mean, it was bad. And, I basically told my boss that I could write the whole thing from scratch faster than I could fixing the bugs. And, at that time they weren't really sure what to think of me. You know, they had never had an intern before. And, he said, well, just, you know, give it a week. And if you can't get progress on it, then maybe I'll rewrite it, you know? After a week, I hadn't made much progress, obviously. And he said, well, what do you think? And I said, I could maybe fix this in the rest of the 3 or 4 months that this co-op runs, or fix part of it, or I could write the entire thing from scratch in a month. And he absolutely didn't believe me. He thought I was crazy and there was no way I was going to write a program in a month that took, you know, like 30 years to put together, you know, although I'm sure it was kind of like a back burner project for them. But he agreed that, I could have a month to do it. And if I didn't, then I would have to go back to the other one. So I was very motivated to make this happen. And after a month, I had a fully working version. So that was a great personal success story for me. And one of my first forays into, the actual software industry.
I just love that story. I think it's just a great story about, you know, your sort of internal motivation to do well and to take on challenges, and even this idea of the Shark Tank, you know, sort of wandering around looking for areas where there's real challenges, where people are kind of stuck, and you're the group that sort of melts that problem, right? creates solutions out of being really agile in your thinking and being really innovative. So it's just such a great story. Let's move into a slightly different area. Can you talk about some of your top ideas around building prototypes and promising new areas using your new governance model based on the lean startup approach coined by Eric Ries?
Yeah, well, let's talk about lean startup a little bit, even though I think a lot of people use it nowadays, so it's not like this magical secret sauce anymore. Lean startup is really just about coming up with what you think are great ideas. Deciding what the minimum viable product is that you can build to test out your theory, that your idea is in fact great, and then throwing it on the fire by asking people, preferably people in your target market, what they think about it, and even better, if they'll pay for it. So to me, really great ideas happen when amazing people come together. And that's what we tried to do at Lockheed. We tried to increase the amount of time these talented individuals talked to each other, and ran into each other in different meetings and events. So just like we expected, this sparked a ton of really great ideas. What became the hard part was deciding which ideas were the most viable and had the most chance of surviving out in the market. And after we chose an idea, we had to rally the team around it, so that they would put all their efforts into that one concept, which sometimes is easier said than done, even with amazing people. And that's sort of the path we take, when we're creating products in our group. I'd love to tell you about some of the products we're developing, but unfortunately those are proprietary.
Oh, that's a shame. Okay, so you did something with TEDx. Can you talk about launching your own TEDx? And because it was really successful, so what are your recommendations if other people want to do the same thing?
Yeah, one of the other leaders in Shark Tank was instrumental in making this happen. He was the coordinator for the entire event. And as far as the lessons we learned, I think, because I was talking to him, if not every day, then, several times a week about what was going on and how things were going. I think it's really important to build a community first if you're going to host a TEDx event. There's a lot that goes into putting on an event like this that we learned about as we were going. And when it's go time, a lot of last minute problems are going to come up. And if it's just you and a few other people, you're going to have a hard time pulling everyone together, right? If you spent the time getting a community of people excited about the event you're putting on, people will naturally volunteer to make things come together. And that's a very powerful thing. And that's exactly what happened when we hosted a TEDx event at Lockheed. We actually got a variety of different groups involved outside of Shark Tank, and we asked them to volunteer their time and put effort towards it. And the community response was overwhelmingly positive. Some other areas of interest were, find a good location that is accessible to a lot of people. If it's not fancy looking, do your best to make it look fancy, which is what we did. We actually borrowed some, we hosted it at a space facility inside Lockheed. So we borrowed some space props, from the company. You don't have to spend a fortune on an event like this. I think in total, we spent about $4,000 and managed to reach somewhere north of 1,000 viewers. You can borrow a lot of things you need if you just ask people. Also, a lot of people volunteer their own time to make the event special. And that goes back to building a community that is excited about what you're doing. Spend plenty of your time advertising to get the word out, and encourage folks to come in person rather than just watching on their computer. Having a live audience, I think, we can all agree will give the event an electric feel and will give energy to your speakers, which is really important. And talking about speakers, a lot of people are not professional speakers. Shocking, I know. The people who are speaking at your event probably won't be professional speakers. So find some good coaches that will sit at the venue and listen to speeches and give your speakers input before the actual event. I think some of the talks at our event were significantly improved after only one session of something like this.
So from a business process standpoint, do you have to formally, talk to the TED organization and say, hey, we want to do this thing? And I mean,
So there's actually a website. You can just go to it, and you fill out a form, and that makes you the official point of contact for your organization. And then they have a bunch of rules that you have to follow for hosting a TEDx event at, your company. So definitely make sure you follow the rules and guidelines that TEDx and TED provide.
And how about sort of the problems associated with videoing? You have to video some of this stuff. Did you hire your own crews? How did you do that?
Yeah, that was actually our major expense. We had to hire a video crew, and that was where the majority of the $4,000 went to. So we had to do all of that, setting it up and everything.
Now, earlier you talked about, you're in school, you develop this game, it gets sort of submitted to this major conference on games and it wins. Well, what are some of the lessons that you can share from this whole process?
Yeah, like I was saying, I think a lot of software developers get into writing code because of video games, which is great. Like we need more people to write code. There's a lot of great jobs that are available if you're not currently writing code and you think you might want to get into it. And when you're younger, you think that creating video games is like this magical fantasy job, right? The truth is, making video games is nothing like playing video games. ultimately, there's a lot of people who want those jobs, and so they're typically paid less than other software engineers and not treated as well. Not to say that they're like flogged or anything, but if you create a game that nobody likes, there's going to be like this stigma attached to you that will follow you around in the video game industry, and nobody will want to hire you. And by the way, if you create a game nobody likes, you can't keep your current job either. So it's a tough industry to make it in. And I guess kudos to all the people in the industry that have made it, because it's an exceptional accomplishment. In my own personal experience, I learned some interesting things. One thing I look back on and laugh at is that I played the game we made so many times for testing purposes that after a couple of months, I didn't even enjoy playing it anymore. And when people told me they loved playing our game, I thought they were fibbing just to be nice. So one thing our team suffered from in particular, despite being incredibly talented folks, and this goes back to the whole lean startup mentality, is that we literally had people offering us money for this game, and we had major distributors willing to distribute it for us. And we literally turned all those things down because the game was never perfect for the team as a whole. Perfection was more important than success at that juncture in our lives, and nobody wanted this stigma of having a bad game released in the industry with their name on it. So ultimately, the game went nowhere. It's funny, a lot of people ask me how much the game was going to cost, and I would say, oh, I don't know, something like $5. And a bunch of those people, parents especially, said things like, God bless you. Here I was thinking I built this game that nobody should even want to play, and I'm getting blessed for telling them a price point I thought was probably too much money. You know, Steven, perception is a crazy thing.
Yeah, and if you, yeah, I guess you got into some called, what I call perfection paralysis, and if you didn't do that, you could be at the top of the gaming world right now.
I know, it's sad, really, but you take these lessons and you move on, you know.
Now, you mentioned that in earlier you talked about the ACM. You're part of this ACM Practitioner Board Professional Development Committee, which provides guidance to a lot of the products and services that are part of the ACM Learning Center. And you're also this really seasoned developer. Like, you've done it a long time. You created this really an amazing, innovative group. So, you know, from that perspective and the fact that we do have many sort of very senior developers in the audience themselves, can you provide some of your software tips in engineering and development?
Sure. So there are so many good tips and so many amazing software engineers out there. I'll try not to bore everybody, but I'll give you a few things that I think about on a regular basis. I always say, I think the most important thing to any piece of software is taking the time to get the architecture right first. It may seem like a good idea to just jump into writing code because it feels like you're making progress, but ultimately this is going to lead to a lot of rewrites, defects, and ultimately bad architecture. The worst part is it's going to take you significantly more time to write your software if you don't plan out a good architecture. I learned that lesson personally in college, so, you know, thank God for that. But we had a bunch of really great professors, and in the software engineering program that I was in, they really stressed writing out your architecture first and those types of things. In this one particular course that was sort of centered around architecture, but you also had to develop working code, on teams, we had the first project that we had to build in 2 weeks. And we decided that we didn't need architecture because we were smarter than that. And we could just jump into writing code. And I can tell you on that first project, it really came down to the wire. Like, we probably submitted the project like a minute before it was due. And it still wasn't perfect because we had to rewrite things so many times. It was really a struggle. And then on the second project, which was the next 2 weeks, we decided that maybe we should try this architecture thing. And we, you know, used UML to diagram our solution. And we took like probably the first several days of our project just getting the architecture right. And it really worried us because we're thinking to ourselves, we're spending all this time drawing diagrams instead of implementing code. We're going to be so screwed when it comes to like getting the project implemented. But what's funny is when we actually created the architecture first, we completed our project early, because we didn't have to rewrite anything. There weren't any bugs because the architecture was sound. And, we're like, this is definitely the way to go in the future. I always tell people that Apple has ruined it for us software engineers, because now we have to be HCI or UI UX capable, and graphic designers as well. People expect that your user interface today is not only functional, but beautiful. It used to be good enough just to have working software. And now your software has to elicit an emotional response from the user. And as software engineers, how do we percolate joy in people by what we show them on the screen? I think that's a tall glass of water. I'm always checking out new apps for ideas, and also drawing inspiration from what I see around me on a daily basis, as far as just walking down the street or going to the park or whatever, going to the beach. If something makes me smile, I always ask myself, you know, what is it about this that made me happy? And then try and see if it's applicable to a project I'm working on, or maybe a new project I might work on. I think it's important to draw inspiration from the things around you, especially when it comes to designing beautiful interfaces that elicit joy out of people. I think that's a really interesting twist that's happened in the software industry, and I attribute that mostly to Apple.
You know, it's kind of interesting. You know, you're talking about sort of gaining inspiration and ideas just by observing things around you, and I guess that gets into what I call integration and synthesis as well. You know, sort of this Bloom's taxonomy, the older idea of Bloom's taxonomy anyways, you know, where it's knowledge, comprehension, application, analysis, synthesis, and evaluation. So those are upper levels, the cognitive functioning that you're doing, or there's this idea of an innovator's DNA, and there's kind of these five attributes of questioning, observing, experimenting, associating, and networking. And this association idea is really this synthesis that you're describing. So it's interesting that you're kind of living sort of these theories that are out there of how to be an optimum performer.
Yeah, I promise you that's completely by accident.
Now, can you talk more about Divine Intervention Software and Rue?
Yeah, so I think I was meant to be an entrepreneur, Stephen. Being crazy enough to start my own organization inside a Fortune 100 company has made that very apparent to me. I'm really passionate about building things that matter and working directly with customers to figure out what's important to them, and seeing their eyes light up when you hand them something that solves a problem for them. I think that's what Divine Intervention Software is about, and it's also my company. Creating software that makes a difference in the lives of people, and all the founders really believe in that mission.
And then Rue?
Rue is one of our first apps. Rue is a social networking app that allows you to meet professionals to do activities with while you're traveling or when you're at home. I think technology is profoundly affecting our lives around human socialization. And you see more and more people complaining about being lonely, but these same people are sitting alone at home checking their Facebook, right? I'm not sure why we're doing this to ourselves. I think it's just how our brain's reward system is wired. We wanted to give people a push in the right direction and try to convince them to use social media to meet and do things in person instead of scroll through a feed all day. So Rue is an attempt at connecting people together.
Now, you've already shared a couple of stories of what I would consider almost impossible challenges and how you're able to master them. You know, working in that signal processing company and taking sort of this software that was so old and yet being able to kind of completely rewrite it in a month, or your game that you produced. Do you have any other stories you can share of impossible challenges you were able to master?
Sure. So before I started managing and leading people, my job was really centered around the fact that I had built this reputation for being at least one of the software engineers at Lockheed that you would call if some other people had told you that your concept was impossible or your schedule was created by a madman. high-level stakeholders came to me and then told me that I had to do it and I had to meet their schedule demands. I'm not sure if I was really that more qualified than other software folks in the company, but for whatever reason, I always accomplished those crazy projects. Maybe it was just because I wasn't given the choice. My personal favorite was when I went to my boss at the time, and told him I was bored. And this was quite a few years ago, so cut me a little slack. I asked him for some more work to do because apparently I enjoy, you know, shooting myself in the foot. He got one of those ominous smiles on his face and he told me he had just the thing. It's usually not a good sign. So he wanted me to build, an app that could dynamically find and call web services on a network. catch in mind that this was before people were even using the term cloud computing. So this was also before REST really took off. So they were all like SOAP-based web services. I explained this task to one of the senior engineers on my team, who then walked into my boss's office and tried to explain to him that the task he had just given me was impossible. at any rate, I wrote some code that read WSDL files and broke them down into tiny pieces and then reassembled them into SOAP envelopes. It's really a miracle it worked at all, but it did in fact work. and that senior engineer told me he was very impressed since it was an impossible project.
Now, because you did something that was impossible, were there some unintended consequences?
yeah, it's really kind of funny. I'm not sure if it was related to it being impossible or not. Obviously, it wasn't impossible, right? But I learned from the same thing that you should never show unfinished products to high-level stakeholders, because after I actually made the core functionality work, I took it to my boss because I was so excited to show him, you know, like this new shiny thing that I had found or made. And all he did was point out all the things that were wrong with it. And, you know, comparatively to what I had created, it was nothing, you know, like it was, you know, little tiny things on the user interface that he wanted changed or whatever. But, you know, like I was crushed after this, that, you know, like I had taken this shiny gem to my high level stakeholder and he just pointed out everything that was wrong with it. So I learned after that to really make like high quality prototypes and high fidelity prototypes, I guess is what they call them. And also like really clean looking interfaces and everything so that I wouldn't have to deal with that, you know, scrutiny again.
Now, you know, there's sort of a follow-up question. Then what additional important lessons can you summarize from the last question?
I would say dealing with quote-unquote impossible projects, right? When you work for a large organization, could be anywhere, you get used to hearing things like, that'll never work, or that's impossible, or we shouldn't waste money on this because it's hard, right? Don't be that person. Be the person that's willing to do and create the hard things. You know, don't let other people stop you with their words. Pursue great things and get those people excited. Get those same people excited about what you've accomplished and what you're going to accomplish next, more importantly.
Now, you've built this pretty amazing career for somebody that's really, really quite young. And so you must have a bunch of resources and other things that you use all the time that you think could be of value to the audience and you can share.
Well, first of all, thank you, Stephen, for that compliment. I appreciate it. I don't know about resources. You know, resources change all the time, especially in the software development community. But I can share some of the lessons I've learned and some of the resources that are tied to them. So, like I was saying, things happen at a breakneck pace in the technology industry today. And what I found is that words are an imperfect mechanism for conveying ideas. So as a software engineer or as a leader of software engineers, I would say learn to draw or learn to use one of the wonderful prototyping tools that make it easy, like Balsamiq. some of the more important things I've learned in my career, I'd say, short as it is that true power comes from influence and not legitimate authority. And I used to think it was the other way around. It's one thing to tell somebody to do something and have them comply because you can fire them. And it's an entirely different thing to ask someone to do something and have them choose to do it because they believe in your vision. So read about and become the next visionary leader at your organization. And if your people wouldn't choose to follow you if they didn't have to, you're only one reorg away from oblivion. The biggest indicator I use to determine if someone is going to be a success is audacity. I actually memorized the definition because I think it's such a powerful word. And the definition is boldness or daring, especially with confident or arrogant disregard for personal safety, conventional thought, or other restrictions. I think that pretty much describes any entrepreneur you've ever met, especially the successful ones. And certainly can describe a lot of really brilliant people inside of large companies. You know, anybody can walk into an office, do your job description from 9 to 5 and then go home. And maybe that's enough for some people, but to me, that's just boring. You know, dare to venture outside the lines of your job description and your organization, wander around your building, ask people what they're working on, choose to make a difference in your own life, in your organization, in the lives of other people by doing the right things to do, even if they're scary or there are consequences, I would say, you know, build meaningful relationships with the people you work with. I'd say that that in itself probably matters even more than the work you're doing at any given moment.
Now, do you have some predictions for the future because you're at the hub or you're kind of the keystone of an ecosystem of talent?
Sure. I mean, we talk about the future all the time in our group. And some of the things that come to mind are that it's only a matter of time before you can Google things with your brain. Sounds kind of scary, actually, to have Google's going to put a chip in your head, but I think it's only a matter of time. I would say it's only a matter of time before little tiny nanobots will live inside you and keep you healthy instead of, you know, taking medication. Speaking of robots, you know, robots will probably handle all the mundane tasks that you don't want to do. Let's see what else. You can speak any language and have it instantly translated in real time to another person speaking a different language and vice versa. I think it's that one's coming probably pretty soon. And lastly, I think 3D printing is really big. I think 3D printers will be in everyone's home and they will replace all shipping and manufacturing, and you'll be able to print out anything you order and pay for, like the atomizer out of Star Trek.
Yeah, it's good. We're kind of due for an exciting future. Now, how can executives act on your predictions?
I would just say hire smart people, give them your vision, and get out of the way. Specifically, if you're looking for specific areas to invest in, I would say nanotechnology, the crossover between biotechnology, medicine, and software, robotics, obviously, and 3D printing are great places to start.
Now, you've achieved a lot of success as an executive in technology, and you have a lot of influence and access because of all the things that you've done, and you've got a great success history. So what are some of your leadership lessons that can be used by others?
Yeah, in my personal career, I would say never underestimate someone who works for you just because they're new or younger than you or they have a different perspective. Diversity is really important, and some of the best ideas I've ever heard came from people who walked in the door for the first day or were lost looking for the coffee room, and we just sort of abducted them into our meeting. And for the love of God, pay attention and respect to your young people. I know they're probably going to make mistakes and they're overly optimistic, but use that energy towards constructive ends, and you will not only gain their loyalty, but you'll probably start beating your competitors because young people know what the next trends are before anyone else usually. Also, find out who your talent is and and make sure they have no reason to leave the company. Replacing your talent is much more difficult than you think. And when they leave, it's a lot harder to get them back, if that's even possible. If you think that HR knows who your talent is, they don't. Unless maybe they have technology degrees. Otherwise, you should probably be asking your technologists, because they definitely know.
Now we're going to start shifting some of the questions here. We're down to our last set. And this one's about computing, and you're in the computing field. Do you think it should be a recognized profession on par with things like accounting, and with sort of areas like demonstrated professional development, adherence to the code of ethics, personal responsibility, public accountability, quality assurance, and recognized credentials?
You know, we've talked about this on the ACM board that we're on, Stephen. And do I think software engineers should be well-trained and perform with excellence on the job and not take advantage of people? Sure, of course, you know. But that being said, government oversight rarely solves these types of problems. And I know a lot about government oversight because I work in aerospace and defense, right? They usually just add a lot of red tape and bureaucracy and confound things. It's already pretty expensive to hire a software engineer. I think the last thing we need is to make it even less affordable and make software customers pay the cost of malpractice insurance for creating software products. I think with the speed of how things change in the software industry, it just doesn't make any sense.
Dom, you have a lot of different interests. You're very eclectic in what you do. Can you talk further about any of these other areas?
I never knew I was eclectic, but I guess that's something you just sort of stumble into, trying different things. I guess I do try a lot of different things. I don't want to keep you here all day, so maybe I could talk about, you know, just one thing. I've always been very much into creating music. I started piano at a very young age and could actually read sheet music before I could read English off the page. I went on to play the piano for over 20 years. I also picked up the trumpet for 10 years, and right around college, it became apparent to me that I wasn't going to be able to bring a piano around with me. They're kind of big and heavy, so I bought a guitar and started teaching myself how to play. A lot of people from my hometown, my very small hometown, thought I was going to become a professional musician after high school, but I could never do that. You know, music has always been my psychology. If I have a bad day, I'll sit down and play something, and then I'll feel better about the world. And if I was depending on creating music to pay my bills, I think I would probably lose that escape and turn into a crazy person.
Now, Dom, you were at you were at CES in January. Did you see that Syntrix device?
I didn't. Please tell me about it.
That's the one, I believe it's the same people who created Guitar Hero that came out with this hardware-software combination where it'll auto-tune your voice, but in addition to that, you can get your voice to simulate an instrument, or you can, using different templates, you can make yourself sound like another entertainer. In fact, there's a gentleman, he did Bohemian Rhapsody, right? but he showed it, he demonstrated without Syntrix, this device, and then afterwards, it was like flawless. It was pretty amazing. So because of your interest in music, I thought maybe you had a chance to see it.
Yeah, there's so many things at CES, Stephen. You know, it's just overwhelming. It was a great experience, though. What I would say about a device like that is, one, it's an incredible accomplishment in technology, but there are some things I think are sacred, and music is one of them. You know, I guess I'm biased in that way. And it's, you know, I think I would much rather hear like someone's genuine, true voice and music than something going through a lot of synthesizers. So for me, I'm not sure I would be a believer in that product simply because I hope that I'm good enough that I wouldn't need it, right? But yeah, I think there's a lot of you can tell a lot about of a person and the honesty and genuineness and the music that they create, whether they're singing a song or they're playing something on an instrument. I think that's a really incredible connection you can have between two people or between one person and a lot of people giving a performance like that.
You know, it's interesting. Maybe this is a philosophical point, but I think it democratizes it so that you may have a lot of creative ideas that are musical in nature, but you may not have the ability to or the time to learn an instrument, or you may not have been born with the ability to kind of vocalize it in a way, but you may have a lot of creative musical ideas, and now you have the ability to sort of, you know, realize some of your kind of creative ideas without having to, you know, have the necessary parts to do it, right?
Yeah, I actually think that's a really great perspective, Stephen. I didn't think of it that way.
You know, you do a lot of traveling and speaking and yeah. Again, you got this really interesting life. Do you have any stories that you can share outside of the ones you already talked about? Maybe something amusing, surprising, unexpected, or amazing?
Sure. You know, we've been talking about technology a lot, as we should. You know, this is the ACM. So I'll mix it up a bit. One thing you should know about me, Stephen, is that I am a terrible surfer, but I love doing it. When you're surfing, you get this instant feedback and the ocean is your critic. If you didn't get up fast enough, you know, here, let me smack you upside the head with this big wave. It's definitely a learning experience and the learning curve is fast. And, like I said, you get instant feedback. Maybe that's why I like it so much. One of the first times I ever went surfing, I was with this friend of mine, who at the time was a coworker, and also much better at surfing than I was. And he was teaching me things like you have to shuffle your feet when you're walking out into the ocean so you don't piss off the stingrays and those such things. Apparently a lot of people, like, they just clomp out into the ocean and they accidentally step on a stingray because they're burrowed in the sand, and the stingrays, they hold that against people. Apparently stingrays hold grudges. I didn't know this. And they might, you know, hit you with a barb. It's probably not going to kill you, but you're going to spend your morning at the emergency room instead of surfing. So not a good idea. Anyway, we were out there in the ocean waiting on our boards for a wave. For those of you who have not surfed, most of surfing is waiting. You don't really get up on a wave very much. You're just out there hanging out with your buddy if you're lucky enough. And, it's kind of like planking in an earthquake. So it's really great ab exercise. And he explained to me as we're waiting out there for a wave that waves always come in sets of three and that a set comes roughly every 5 minutes. That may seem mundane and uninteresting to you, but when I was out there, it was an incredible notion to me. And there is that level of constancy to something I just viewed as chaos before. And in that one moment, I felt completely connected to the universe. Like this massive body of water that made up the Pacific Ocean was somehow a part of me. And that might make me sound like a hippie, but, I've learned in life that meditation is actually super important for maintaining your mental health and stamina and as a technologist and a leader. So my friends and I, who are technically sadly, actually talk about meditation and this sort of stuff all the time.
I see. Mindfulness meditation, I guess.
Right.
Now, you choose a topic area. What do you see as some of the top challenges facing us today, and do you have any solutions?
Oh, Stephen, you know, there's a lot of problems out there today that to be solved. And I think that's why entrepreneurs are so great. They're trying to tackle some of these problems. Education is a big one for me. I think it costs too much, so it's not accessible to a lot of people. And most people don't have enough of it. Kind of goes back to your saying, like, how can you be an amazing musician if you don't have the skills, right? We need to even the playing field. And the things we teach in high school don't prepare kids for the real world. And that's, you know, the harsh reality of it. I think MOOCs or massive open online courses are a step in the right direction, providing on-demand, high-quality content for anyone that wants to learn. I think we should let kids specialize earlier in things that interest them using a model similar to MOOCs with some oversight to make sure they aren't getting lost or going down a rabbit hole. Being such that I work with government a lot, I think government is another big problem. At least in the US, there's no such thing as the voice of the people anymore. I'm not sure if our government is more or less corrupt than the third world governments you hear about on the news. I think our government is probably just more clever about spending it. I wish that I were smart enough of a person to fix this one, but it's a pretty big problem, right? I think there has to be more transparency at the very least. I've always liked the idea that some comedian said that politicians should have to wear jumpsuits with their sponsors on them, just like race car drivers. I read a story that, taking it back to technology a little bit, I read this story that this kid wrote a Chrome plugin that tells you who each politician is supported by when you're reading the news, on your computer or on your phone and their name comes up. We need more of that sort of thing. I think, accountability is key, and I want politicians in office that consider the job a burden, because somebody had to do it, not a strategic position for personal gain. We're getting pretty serious now, but lastly, you know, I think extremism is a big problem we're facing today. You know, everything in moderation. Ultimately, this sort of behavior only leads to destruction. The easy thing to talk about here is religion, right? But really, this could be as simple as some guy mutating the rabies virus in his basement and bringing on the zombie apocalypse because his girlfriend broke up with him. You know, focusing on one thing for too long is like eating too much ice cream. It's going to make you sick.
Hey, those are really interesting ideas. And we're down to our last question, and it's, again, it's kind of open-ended. And I'm turning the tables and saying that if you were conducting this interview, what questions would you have asked, and then what would be your answers?
You know, we've learned a lot about me here today, Stephen. And speaking of turning the tables, I actually want to turn the tables on you because I'm really interested to know more about you. And I'd like to turn this around a bit and ask you three questions. You know, you're a very interesting guy, and I'm sure inquiring minds want to know. So hopefully you don't cut this out of our interview, right? But what makes you get up every morning? What gets you excited about starting the day?
Making a difference and having impact. Making the world a better place, but doing it in a way that's demonstrated and implementable.
Interesting. You know, what is the reason you got into the technology field?
I find that technology allows you to be creative and to make dramatic shifts at a regional, at a national, and even at a global level. And because it's can be integrated into every aspect of our lives, I think it's the greatest tool that one could use, or tools that one could use to have that impact, to make the world a better place.
Yeah, that's really great. And for my last question, what is the one thing you'd like to accomplish most before your time is up on this earth?
What I'm doing now, and that is to get into a position where I can set up foundations to work on some of the serious issues that are out here in the world. And to basically give any funding or any amount of wealth that I'm able to build, to donate it all to these foundations to solve some of the issues that are pressing in the world today.
That's a really great goal, Stephen, and hopefully I can help you towards some of those endeavors.
Well, it was interesting for you to turn the tables and ask me questions, so that was fun. Dom, I know that you're a really busy innovator, and you know, we're indeed fortunate you took the time to do this interview and just share so many insights and your passion with our audience.
It's been an absolute pleasure, Stephen. Thanks so much for having me.
I'm Stephen Ibaraki, and this concludes our exclusive interview with Dominique Holt, co-founder and leader of Lockheed Martin Shark Tank organization. Now, Dom is a top international software engineer and innovator, a leading entrepreneur, and he's a member of the ACM Practitioner Board Professional Development Committee.